Welcome to Students Over Systems, where we talk with the creators, advocates, and beneficiaries of education freedom. I'm your host, Jenny Gentles. On today's episode, we're going to talk about restoring U.S. history and civics in America's schools. And as we wrap up the episode, we'll bring it back to our favorite topic, school choice. For this important discussion, we're joined by Jamie Gass, who is co-editor of a new book, Restoring the City on a Hill, U.S. History and Civics in America's Schools. Jamie's the director of the Center for School Reform at the Pioneer Institute. He has more than three decades of experience in public administration and education reform at the state, local, and school district levels. At Pioneer, he's framed, commissioned, and managed over 100 research papers and numerous policy events on K-12 education reform topics. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us on Students Over Systems.
Thanks for having me on, Jenny.
So this is a little different of a topic for us here at Students Over Systems, but I'm excited to delve into it because it is an important one. Your new book, Restoring the City on a Hill, U.S. History and Civics in America's Schools, highlights how there was a handful of states that developed really excellent history and civic standards in the 1990s. We know from NAEP scores and beyond that we don't have really excellent history and civics instructions or outcomes right now. Let's delve into the history of what's happened. But before we do that, can you explain how state standards differ from curriculum?
Sure, it's a great question. And there's often a lot of kind of misconceptions about the two. So the state standards are sort of the framework or sort of the larger lattice of topics or authors or sequencing that all school districts, public school districts are supposed to follow in their state. And every state, largely due to No Child Left Behind, but a lot of the reforms that came out of the 1990s developed their own state standards that are then aligned with the state tests. And then a curriculum is the locally generated content that goes into a lot more detail. That's something that teachers and principals and superintendents are supposed to be doing at the state or at the school level. But in truth, most places just use the state standards as a kind of de facto curriculum because they know they're going to be tested on it. But that's not really what a curriculum is supposed to be about.
Okay, we hear a lot about teachers going to Pinterest and clicking around on the internet in order to put together lesson plans. If there was a curriculum in place, they wouldn't have to do that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. In a way, it's sort of an admission that the curriculum work at the local level isn't being done or done very well. And so, I mean, in an ideal world, what you would hope is that you'd have teachers and principals and superintendents that were knowledgeable enough in academic content so that they could develop their own curriculum. Now, many places do, but the reality is that a lot of it isn't very good. And so they buy off the shelf curricular materials that are aligned with textbooks, which also aren't very good. And so, in a way, the ideal would be to have well-educated teachers in the content area so they are able to develop that those materials on their own.
Well, from a parent perspective, I have to say my daughter in seventh grade has an American history and kind of civics textbook. And I just love that there is a textbook in today's era where the teachers are cobbling together lessons and clicking around and putting things together. And parents have no idea what the outcome of that is. I love that that textbook regularly comes home. I can read it. I can know what she's learning. And I can, have my own opinions and share them with her when I do quibble a bit with what the textbook is saying. Okay, so let's talk about history of the history standards a little bit. What was the impetus for creating those standards in the 1990s? A lot of times we think, oh, education was fine before. It's just awful now. Was there something amiss that led to these history standards?
So yeah, in 1983, well-known report, A Nation at Risk, was authored by the U.S. Department of Education. And it basically said that the problems across K-12 public education were the equivalent of, if a foreign enemy had sort of imposed it on us, it would be an act of war. So it was that was sort of the fire bell in the night, if you will. But it really left it up to the states to figure out how to address education reform, because naturally, both by law and constitution and custom, and financial backing, the states and localities are primarily responsible for education. We don't have a national system of education in this country. And so I'll just use the example of a state like Massachusetts. We had a very unique moment in the early 90s. We had a Republican governor, Bill Weld. We had sort of reform-oriented and very content-strong Democratic leadership and in our legislature. And they got together and created this big education reform bill. They put a lot more money into the system in exchange for very high quality academic standards in English, math, science, and history, high stakes testing to go with it. So the assurance was that if kids were able to be taught these standards and with a decent curriculum at the local level, that they could pass a test and needed to pass a test so their diploma actually meant something. And then they also went a step further where they developed a state driven teacher test that was also aligned with the state standards and with the exit exam for the kids. Also included great school choice options like charter schools that became the envy of the country. But in Massachusetts, that was sort of the grand bargain that made for good politics and good policy. And that's how Massachusetts got really great English, math, science, and history standards in the 90s and early 2000s. That led to the historic gains on NAEP and TIMSS and PISA, all the international measures in English and math and science. But Massachusetts never implemented the state standards in history and civics and never tied it to a state test in history and civics the way they were supposed to by the law.
Okay. Talking about that law getting passed, a lot of times when we are seeing state leaders try to push through reforms, big or small, the first out the gate opposition comes from the teachers unions. And I know you all have powerful teachers unions in Massachusetts. I've been following the strikes in Newton most recently. What was the position of the unions, or were they quiet on all this?
Well, you know, the teachers unions were never big fans of the Ed Reform Law in 1993 in Massachusetts, but we were unique in the sense that we had political leadership primarily in the legislature that had street cred with other members of organized labor so that they could say no to the teachers unions on key elements of the law, like charter schools and testing and teacher testing and high academic standards. And so a lot of it was really driven by legislative leaders who themselves were products of either high quality Catholic schools or elite prep schools, who had a sensibility that was kind of grounded in a much more traditional understanding of not only history, because in the law, they actually specifically said you need to teach the founding documents, the Federalist Papers, state history, labor history, et cetera. But because of their own education and the education of Bill Weld, who was a classics major from Harvard, their sensibilities were totally different from what had sort of driven poor quality performance in states for decades in this country. And so that was sort of the secret sauce, is that we had political leadership that was really high quality and academic content, knew what they wanted. And we also had then good Board of Education appointees, people like Jim Pizer, Abigail Thernstrom, Roberta Schaefer, John Silber, the president of BU, who also knew what a good quality liberal arts education looked like, grounded in high quality content. So that was the sort of the game changer. It was a confluence of good, really high quality political leadership who could put together the deals and say no to the unions, and then excellent gubernatorial appointees that could use the Board of Ed and the state bureaucracy to push through the kind of standards and academic expectations that led to our big gains.
Sounds like a model for other states. Speaking of which, the book does say that there were a handful of states that were passing these standards. So I know you're based in Massachusetts, and that's the focus of your work. Can you give examples of some of the other states that did this?
Sure. So Indiana, for example, has long been a leader in K-12 education standards. They had excellent and have excellent history standards. And the thing about Indiana is that they started really quite young. They started in the elementary school grades. That's very unique. South Carolina is another state that, going back several decades, has really high quality history and civic standards. In the 90s, under the old Diane Ravitch, she developed the history and civic standards in California. California had very good standards. New York's actually weren't that bad. But what's happened in a lot of the blue states, like California and New York, and it's happened in Massachusetts too, is that over time, the sort of the bureaucracy and the players and special interests are pretty good at watering down or dumbing down the standards in a way to placate the teachers' unions, who at the end of the day don't really have much love for high academic quality.
Right. The book description says that you chronicle a slow retreat from those standards in favor of educational fads. And that's something that I rant about a fair bit, just how captive the K-12 system is to fads, just constantly throwing away good ideas or even throwing away the latest fad to move on to the next thing, which has to be exhausting for teachers, has to be exhausting for principals who are trying to implement whatever's coming down from above. What's the evidence of this slow retreat or slow abandonment of rigor?
Yes, it's a great question. And you're absolutely right. I mean, if there's one thing that has sort of plagued American public education and education more generally for decades, has been this going guardrail to guardrail on the fads. And I mean, a lot of it is driven by progressive education itself, which has this view that we're ever in this exploring process of finding out what works. The reality is, at this point, we have a pretty good sense of what works. But it also just coincides with textbook manufacturers, et cetera. But the evidence in Massachusetts and a lot of other places, in fact, they tried to begin to water down the standards back under Governor Patrick in 2010 or so. Big push for 21st century skills, sort of soft skills. I mean, that outlook of softer skills, you know, media literacy, cross-cultural competence. I mean, you've probably heard all these buzzwords before, but that was the original pass, was to get rid of these very traditional standards. I mean, Sandra Stotsky developed all the standards in Massachusetts. I've had people tell me that what was in the previous Massachusetts English, math, science, and history standards was on par or better than what you would have found at an elite prep school in the 50s. So it gives you a real sense they're very traditional standards and high quality. But the system can't handle this. And so while they weren't able to really open the standards in Massachusetts or a lot of states with the 21st century skills back in 2010, and around 2018 or so, they did do that in Massachusetts and a lot of those states. And now you see a big push for what they call action civics, which is really just training kids to be sort of political activists or sort of community organizers, rather than grounding them in the sort of enduring content of the founding documents, the Federalist Papers, all the touchstones of history that would allow them to be knowledgeable enough to and understand the basic vocabulary of our democracy.
You've mentioned the Federalist Papers and those founding documents a couple of times now, and that 1993 law in Massachusetts explicitly required instruction about the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, the U.S. Constitution. I sometimes wonder, though, could students today actually read those documents, much less comprehend them and complete lessons on them? Our reading proficiency levels are so low. It's so alarming. I can't even imagine teachers trying to tackle that content with kids. I'd like to think that it is still happening in some places. Do you have evidence of that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and a valid one too. I mean, it's even little things. I mean, not that what kids are going to be reading is in cursive, but of course the founding documents are in cursive. That too kind of went out under Common Core. Actually, kids either practicing cursive or being able to read cursive. So it's a great question, and there's no question about it. We live in a country where 2/3 of the kids aren't reading at grade level, even though we're spending a king's ransom in terms of per pupil expenditure. But there are a lot of examples. I'm the judge from Massachusetts for the We the People, the Citizen, and the Constitution. It's a national contest that's been around since the late 80s, and there are thousands of kids that go through this program every year. Granted, a lot of them are AP students or kids that are in high school that are more serious about teaching, learning history and civics, but they're able to not only write, brief statements that they present publicly, but then engage in sort of Q&A about Federalist Number 10 and know all the ins and outs of the Federalist Papers and Supreme Court decisions. So I think, a lot of the problem of what's plagued public education or education more generally in this country is the low expectations. I think if you look at a lot of other countries, they have just much higher expectations. And of course, kids tend to meet the level of expectations that the adults set for them. That was certainly true in Massachusetts. It's been true in other states that have seen big gains in the last 15, 20 years in education reform. And I think that's a lot of what's required is keep setting the bar higher and higher so that the challenge is to get kids over that high bar.
Well, part of setting the bar higher in Massachusetts was requiring a U.S. history test as a high school graduation requirement. What's the status of that in Massachusetts, and do other states do this as well?
So very few states do it. Very few states, those 7 or 8 states, maybe have a history requirement at all. And Massachusetts, in spite of all these historic successes on NAEP and TIMSS and PISA, all these, the Ed Reform Law was a landmark accomplishment, and then it created, remarkable results. But as I mentioned, the issue of the history and the civic standards has been controversial. The State Department of Education and Republican and Democratic governors and the legislature have never implemented the law. So you'd think the sort of the first principle of history and civics and teaching it to young people would have the adults actually obeying the law. And the law is quite specific about what's to be taught and it's to be tested. We at Pioneer even work with someone in philanthropy to come up with the $2.5 million to pay for the test.
Wow.
And, the state government basically looked the gift horse in the mouth and said, no thanks. And so a lot of that, I think, frankly, is driven by the fact that the teachers union and the bureaucracies, and it's not unusual to Massachusetts, they have their own agenda, and it's often a pretty politicized agenda, frankly, about history and civics. And so if you're spending a lot of time learning about the founding fathers or the founding documents or the touchstones of history, then there's much less room for them to put in the sort of politicized agenda that you find, whether it's whether it's all this woke stuff or whether it's kind of turning kids into little community organizers. That seems to be their priority because that's what they preference.
I wonder if people can connect those like you did. I feel like that's a really important point that they need the time. They need to program the kids. And it's hard, first of all, to teach the Federalist Papers, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and real substantial history lessons. So I imagine that's one aspect that they're trying to get away from, but also it's time consuming. I hadn't thought about that. That's alarming. Also alarming are the outcomes in our country when it comes to history and civics. So let's go through some NAEP scores. 2022 NAEP history results, 13%, and I believe, yeah, these are eighth graders, 13% were at or above proficient, 13. And so sometimes we think, oh, well, it's COVID closures. It tore apart our education system. But in 2018, long before the school closures, 15% of eighth graders were proficient. So it declined, of course, but it was already so abysmal. So that's history. And then civics, 22% proficient in 2022 and 24 in 2018. So again, a 2 percentage point decline post-COVID closures, but abysmal all around. Okay, so I look at these scores and I just despair. You look at them and can you advise us on what should be done?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a devastating set of data, and it's been that true for decades. I mean, it really, I have to say, is disgraceful because the fact is that K-12 education in this country, going back to the founding era, was intended to be a wellspring of teaching history and civics. That was the whole point of public education, and I think people often focus on STEM, and rightfully. I mean, having well-educated people that are able to do mathematics and science and engineering is enormously important for our competitiveness. That is without question important. But you got to sort of walk and chew gum at the same time. And the reality of it is that as poorly as we have done, and we are, something like 20th in the world in terms of STEM performance, we're even lower performing in civics, which is, you'd think that if we're going to be a city on a hill, if we're going to be this great model of democracy, if we're going to have people that are well educated enough to vote or sit on a jury, that they've got to know the basic vocabulary, the basic history and historical touchstones, warts and all, in order to understand and be an active participant. And so I do think having good state standards is important. I think that having a state test, a high stakes test, is important. I think that, I mean, unlike other NAEP tests, we don't have it ranked by state. So we know that Massachusetts or Minnesota or New Hampshire or whatever are generally high performing. We know some of the lower performing. We really don't have any idea how states stack up because they don't have state level data on NAEP. So I think that would be something that would be helpful because it would help shine a light on the places that are doing a good job. But I think also it really is incumbent on governors and state legislators to drive these kind of policies that we know, if they're done well, work. And then, of course, look, the reality of it is that I was talking with someone the other day at an event, and she was talking about how they have a grandchild who goes to a private school. The private school teaches all the founding documents, teaches all the touchstones. So, the more educationally pluralistic options we have for families, it helps keep I mean, not only does the evidence is that they deliver really good results for kids and families that they like and the people get to pick. But on top of that, when you have that performance and that competition from through school choice, then you also keep the public system honest, and people have choices, so they can leave the system if it's not teaching enough about the founding documents or Frederick Douglass or Lincoln or World War I or World War II or the Cold War, et cetera. So, I mean, this is vitally important knowledge for kids to have, particularly in our democracy. And I think we have to look at put all the options on the table, because at the end of the day, it's the survival of our liberties, our rights, and the rule of law depend on it.
Well, I know when my children were at the local public school, there was no textbook. There was no sense of like what my kids were going to be learning. One of my daughters would just like paste worksheets into a notebook. It was a very strange approach. And now, as I mentioned, my seventh graders at a school that is a private school, and we have a textbook. We have very clear delineation of what she's learning. I see the study guides. I see all the handouts, just so much paper. And I love it. I love being involved. I love knowing what's going on. I love the fact that a parent could say, "Hey, the private school down the street has a textbook. What are you guys doing?" It doesn't have to be this way. So it can be even on straightforward things like that. Just bring back some kind of academic transparency so we know what you are teaching in history and so we can be involved in that process. All right, I want to do a little bit more compare and contrast on public and private schools and outcomes there. But before we do that, I did read in the Washington Post that seven states require a full year of civics or government for high school, and seven have standalone civics requirements for middle school. Most elementary schools allot only a half an hour per week to social studies. Let's set aside that social studies thing because I don't even know what that means. But would more civics instruction help or not, given what you've been saying about the quality of current civics instruction?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's like if you eat three Big Macs, are you going to be healthy? But if you eat five, are you going to be healthier? Probably not. I mean, that's the thing, is that the academic quality is so poor and the expectations are so low, and it's a real problem, because the teachers themselves, I mean, that's part of what Massachusetts did that was, I think, on the right track, is that they aligned a teacher test in an academic content area. So if you're going to teach history or civics, guess what? You actually have to know some history and civics, not just some, kind of boilerplate, skills-based teacher tests that most states have. And so, that relationship between the standards, the teacher test, and the student test is an important one. But look, we've got it. There are a variety of good offerings out there in terms of civics, the We the People, the Citizen, the Constitution. That's a good textbook, and I've judged for almost 30 years in We the People. It's good. Hillsdale offers really good materials. E.D. Hirsch's Core Knowledge Foundation offers good materials. So there are good materials out there. But that issue of academic quality is central, and one that's really kind of absent from a lot of policy discussions. So I think That has got to be front and center. I mean, it's a fundamental question. I mean, if you're in a school or you're in a school district, and most of the conversation is about process and bureaucracy and not the substance of what's taught. I mean, at the end of the day, the curriculum really is what everything should be organized around at a school, whether it's a private school, a religious school, or whether it's a public school of different kinds. The reason why kids are there is for an academic education that is grounded in essentially transferring knowledge from a competent teacher to the kids. And so that's got to be central to it. And it requires a lot of thorny questions about what you teach. I mean, a lot of the reason why history and civics has struggled so much is that people can't agree on what should be taught and how it should be taught. And so the sort of the default switch has been don't do it at all. And that's what we've been experiencing for almost 30 years.
Okay, so private schools, though, seem to be doing it and doing it fairly well, at least in a general sense. I've seen a couple studies come out very recently that reveal that private school students show higher levels of civic knowledge and engagement. I think I'm characterizing those studies correctly. Have you found evidence of this in your research?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that goes back at least a decade or so. The evidence is pretty strong that the kids that go to Catholic schools, Jewish day schools, many or some charter schools, that the private schools do a really good job at teaching history and civics. And that is enormously important because you can point to it as an example of places that know how to do it, want to do it. And not surprisingly, a lot of the private religiously affiliated schools have more of an academic focus. I mean, the truth of it is that a lot of public schooling is sort of more of a socialization process than anything. The academic quality, too many public schools isn't very good. And so the private and parochial schools have way more flexibility about hiring, firing teachers, and generally have chosen liberal arts centric teachers. They often will get, and you see it at charter schools, you see it at elite private schools. They get Ivy League educated or very well educated folks with a liberal arts background. Sometimes they'll do a teacher preparation program within the school, or they'll do a crash course on pedagogy and how to teach during the summer, or help support the teacher. But the main thing that they look for is academic knowledge. To be able to make that material, that history, those civics come alive for kids, so that it really is not just a bunch of dates or names that kind of pass through people's memory quickly, but really to bring history alive using narratives and primary sources and having a firm grounding in the people that really shaped and drove our republic. And so that's what I think needs to happen is that we need to look at the examples of the private and religious schools because they are getting it right in a lot of ways.
Well, as we wrap up the Students Over System episode each time, we always ask our guests, what is the school choice myth that bothers you the most and that you want to dispel today? And feel free to tie it to this discussion of history and civics that we've been having.
Sure. So a couple of years ago, we did an event on charter schools with Sherrill Brown Henderson. She's the daughter of Oliver Brown, who brought the Brown v. Board of Education case, which is going to be celebrating its 70th anniversary this spring. And she had a great saying, which is, there's no us and them, there's only us. And I think when it comes to history and civic education, that's a good model, is that we need to have history and civics serve as a goal for sort of educating common purposes, irrespective of whether kids are going to a private school or they're going to a religious school or charter school. And so one of the myths that I think is bothers me the most, it's somehow charter schools or private or parochial school students are other. They're not part of the mainstream. They're not part of the sort of the democratic experience, when the evidence, as you said earlier, is that there's a lot of research is that the private schools and school choice helps drive often a more dynamic and detailed understanding of history and civics.
Oh, that's fantastic. How can parents and listeners find your organization, your work, your book?
Yeah, at pioneerinstitute.org.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Jamie, for joining me today and for advancing ideas that encourage informed citizens and a vibrant civic life.
Thanks so much, Jenny. Appreciate it.
We hope listeners found today's conversation informative and encouraging. If you enjoyed this episode of Students Over Systems, please consider leaving a review on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to share this episode with your friends. To learn more about the work of the IWF Education Freedom Center, please go to iwf.org/EFC. Thank you for listening to Students Over Systems. Until next time, keep celebrating education freedom and brighter futures.